Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box.
Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the 200th episode of the Film Stories podcast.
If you build it, you will come.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very, very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of this podcast is it's always to tell the stories of film. And I've been telling production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs really that go to make the films that we know and love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. This, though, is a special episode for a couple of reasons for me. First of all, it is the 200th episode of Film Stories, something of which I'm still pinching myself a little bit. Secondly, it's an episode that I'm devoting just to one film, which I don't usually do, and I'm devoting it to a film that's enormously special to me. So I'm kind of at the goosebump stage already with this one. Unusually as well, this is quite a podcast. I mean, this is quite a spoiler heavy podcast episode. If you've not seen the film I'm going to be talking about, it's genuinely best to avoid this one. Usually I go spoiler free, but this is for reasons that will become clear. This is one where I'm digging a lot deeper into story beats as well as the story of the making of the film. Because what I've brought in is a very special guest to join me for this 200th episode, and he doesn't give many interviews about this film, and I'm absolutely thrilled that he spared me the time to do so for this. It's the writer and director of Field of Dreams, a man called Phil Alden Robinson. Now, I and in conjunction with Plumeria Pictures, Film Stories put out a Blu-ray release of his brilliant film Sneakers earlier this year, and he did promise me back then that he would return for a Field of Dreams special, and he has been as good as his word. If you are unfamiliar with the film, then it's 1989's Field of Dreams I'm talking about, adapted from W.P. Kinsella's book Shoeless Joe, starring Kevin Costner, Amy Madigan, James Earl Jones, Ray Liotta and Burt Lancaster, with the script by Phil Alden Robinson, who directed the movie as well. One or two other bits and bobs just to make you aware of throughout the conversation. We're going to be talking about the producers. I think that's quite self-explanatory as it comes up. But also at one stage, Phil Alden Robinson mentions James Horner. Now, James Horner composed, the late, great James Horner composed the score for the movie. It's one of my favourite scores of all time. But his name just gets dropped in and we've not explained that. So if you're coming to it fresh, that's why and that's who he is. Also, we reference reference something that's happened fairly recently, whereby for it was a delayed game, but there was for the 30th anniversary of the film, it was announced that Major League Baseball in the US would be holding a special exhibition game between the Chicago White Sox and the New York Yankees at the site where Field of Dreams was shot. Now, that was delayed. It took place in 2021 in the end, and we talk about that a bit at the end, as well as a planned television spin-off series for the show. So those are all the bits and bobs I think you need to know going in. For those of you to whom this film is as special to as me, I hope you get as much out of this as I did. And whether even if you're coming into it relatively fresh, I think Phil Alden Robinson talks so candidly about the movie. I just hope you find it as fascinating as I did. I'm going to play a slightly elongated intro clip to this one. I mean, you try cutting this one short. And then we will go into my conversation with Phil Alden Robinson.
Ray, people will come, Ray.
They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door, as innocent as children, longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it. For it is money they have, and peace they like.
Ray, just sign the papers.
And they'll walk out to the bleachers. Sit in shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. Find you have reserved seats somewhere along one of the baselines where they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes. And they'll watch the game, and it'll be as if they dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick they'll have to brush them away from their faces.
Ray, when the bank opens in the morning, they'll foreclose.
People will come, Ray.
That then was a clip from 1989's Field of Dreams. I mean, it would be wrong of me to kind of overhype a film or to big it up a little too much. So I just want to tenderly lead in by declaring it the best film ever made. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined for this very, very special episode by the man who wrote the film and the man who directed it, Phil Alden Robinson. Hello, Phil Alden Robinson. How are you?
I'm fine, Simon Brew. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. I trust this finds you well and in good spirits and happy.
Thank you for asking, all of the above. Yes. Well, I hope you and yours are too.
Well, we're still bumbling on. We're still bumbling on. It seems I where to start on something that's so special to me personally, but also so special to lots of other people. I will come to one or two criticisms, lest you think this is going to be an outright sycophantic interview, but it won't be too far off that. But I'm curious where this project found you in the first place, because there's a lovely DVD release where you put together a Field of Dreams scrapbook, which tells bits and bobs of the story of this in a really compelling way. But I'm kind of interested in you as the human being in the midst of it all, that you read this book written by W.P. Kinsella, Shoeless Joe. And if I've got it right, it came out in 1982. I think the chronology seems you got hold of a copy pre-publication. But I wonder if you can tell me where you were personally in your career at that point, and then your response to the book.
I did not get it pre-publication. I was given a paperback of it. I had not yet gotten a movie made. I was working on a screenplay at a small company called Avco Embassy Productions. It was one of my first jobs. And the young woman who was the story editor that I was working with, he had just been promoted from secretary to story editor, later became president of MGM. Her name is Lindsay Durant.
Oh, okay.
She's a wonderful and brilliant woman. And she said, I found this book. There was a producer at Avco Embassy named Peter Fetterman. He was a British gentleman. He now runs a wonderful photo gallery, a fine art photography gallery here in Los Angeles. But at the time, he was producing a movie called Yes, Giorgio, which was the Pavarotti romantic comedy. And Peter's a lovely guy, and he got on a plane. He was in an airport in the States, wanted to get a book to read on the plane. And he went into the newsstand at the airport and those little circular carousels of paperbacks. And he saw the cover of this book. It was a ghostly figure on a baseball field. And he said, I don't know anything about baseball, but the cover is interesting. So he bought this book, read it on the plane, called Lindsay and said, this is a great book. It's not for me, but you, I think you'd like it. She read it, loved it, and said to me, you have to read this book. Now, I was at that point in my career, I was desperate to be hired for more movies. Yeah. So I was inclined to like this. And I said, what's it about? She said, it's about a farmer. And I said, gee, I'm not really, I'm a kind of a city boy and I don't, not really interested in those stories. She said, whoa, wait, he hears a voice. And I said, oh, this is really, really not for me. I am the least new age person you'll ever meet. I don't believe in voices or heaven or hell or reincarnation or astrology or any of that stuff. She said, but it gets better. He has to go kidnap J.D. Salinger. And I said, okay, just stop right there. This sounds so stupid that there is a 0% chance I'm going to read this book. And she said, no, you're going to go home tonight and you're going to read this book. And it was the first time since high school that someone had given me homework, or college, I guess. And I resented it. And I took the book home and I was unhappy and I put it aside and I had dinner and I watched some television. And finally about 10:30, I thought, okay, I'll crack it open. I'll read a chapter and then tell her in the morning, I don't like it. You know, the expression couldn't put the book down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only time in my life. I sat up all night long until I finished this book. I read it in one sitting. And in the morning I called her and said, this is the greatest thing I've ever read. We have to do this. We couldn't get Avco Embassy to buy the rights. They thought it was silly. In fact, we couldn't get anybody to buy the rights. No one in Hollywood in a position to buy a book thought you could make a movie out of this. And I was too dumb and inexperienced to know that you couldn't make a movie out of this. It just seemed like a no-brainer to me. It was emotional and it was visual and had great characters and it was full of surprises. I kept thinking, what do I not know that I need to know in order to understand why no one will do this? And it took a couple of years before Larry Gordon at 20th Century Fox bought the book and hired me to write it.
So, I mean, just to contextualize where you were at this point, you were what, your late 20s, early 30s, just breaking into Hollywood screenwriting? Because you had some screenplays in, certainly in the works, it seems, by that point.
I was only 2 years in the Writers Guild. I'd written a couple of episodes of a TV show.
Yeah.
I'd written, I think, one screenplay for hire.
Yeah.
I was working on my second screenplay for hire, but neither had gotten made at that point. I was 32 when I read the book.
And so you talk about Larry Gordon and Chuck Gordon, Charles Gordon, yes, coming on board. And I mean, obviously, to a generation of them, they're defined almost by some of their late 80s movies, the Die Hards and the Predators. I love the fact that when you were talking to Larry Gordon, he'd just done Xanadu, If I've Got My Timing Right. And there's a film not enough people talk about. But even though that they were positioned within 20th Century Fox and had a degree of clout, and presumably at this point you did not, no disrespect, but you know, the food chain seemed fairly good. What was their response? Because this didn't strike me from any point looking at it as anything close to a commercial film.
That is one of the most perceptive questions that no one has ever asked me, and I'm happy to tell you the reason. Larry Gordon had a very strained relationship with his father. When Larry left Mississippi to come to Los Angeles to work in Hollywood, his father said to him, don't do it. They're going to eat you up and spit you out. You're going to be a failure. And they had a big fight. And he came to Los Angeles, and his father went into the hospital for an operation and died on the table before Larry and his father could reconcile. So this story really struck deeply into Larry's heart and his psyche. It is, as you say, unlike anything he had produced before. But I think looking back now, it's probably the film that means the most to him because of that personal experience that he'd had.
I got, I mean, reading around his response to it, I got as a studio buy, he'd actually turned it down at one point. Is that correct?
I don't think he did. He was president of Fox when he bought the book. And hired me. While I was writing it, he lost his job, and every president of a studio does eventually. And part of his deal was, I get to produce this movie.
Yeah.
So he got the rights as a producer. It was the next president of 20th Century Fox who passed on the project, who turned it down.
And so, again, contextualizing, if I've got this right as well, because we've spoken before on another film of yours that I'm a great fan of, but you were already working on Sneakers at this point. It seemed to me, if I've got my timelines right, Sneakers, if anything, came before this, but Sneakers was ultimately made afterwards.
That is true. I was hired to write Sneakers before I got hired to write Shoeless Joe, because it took me, I think, about 4 or 5 years to get it set up. I also, during that time, wrote a movie called All of Me.
Yes. Carl Reiner.
Yeah. The great Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
So I was just beginning to get hot when I finished the script of Shoeless Joe.
So when Larry Gordon, I mean, Fox decides to pass on the project, and Larry Gordon presumably is the one who then gets it to Universal somehow. But what's the intervening part of that for you? Because there's I understand that you pushed the project and were keen to write it. There's quite a leap to then directing it as well. And I just wonder if you can fill in just a couple of those years for us.
Well, the fascinating thing is, when they first called me about writing the project, I said, I also want to direct it. And they said, fine.
That right, from the off.
Yeah. And I had, during that time, I had written this film called In the Mood and got to direct that as my first film. It didn't make any money, but that didn't seem to deter anybody. And in fact, Fox made a writing directing deal with me before I directed In the Mood. So this could have been my first directing.
So In the Mood came out in 87, and then and then Field of Dreams would kick in following that for you, and presumably set up at Universal then. But if I can just ask you one or two questions just about the process of adapting this book, because, I mean, first of all, it's interesting you kept W.P. Kinsella, who I think you call Bill, but I've not met him, so I can't call him Bill. You kept him close to the project, and you kept him to some degree involved. Can you tell me about that? About your decision there, because it's not that common from what I see.
It's more common than you'd think. I know a lot of writers who will get in touch with the author of a book that they're adapting because they love the book. Otherwise, why adapt it? And in this case, I was just enamored of it. And I called him up. I got his number from his agent. I called him up. He didn't know anything about this. And I introduced myself. I told him I was going to write this, and he said, oh, fine. Well, just let me know how it goes and if I can be of any help. So I went to work on a first draft, and I realized I'm making some big changes, and I hope he's going to be okay with them. So I wrote him a long letter. It was probably a 3-page letter explaining the changes that I'd made and why I had to make them, and sent it along with the script. The first draft that we published. Weeks went by, I didn't hear from him. And I just thought, oh my God, this is a disaster. I've hurt this person who created this thing and I love. Unbeknownst to me, he was in Hawaii on vacation. And when he came home, he read the letter, he read the script. No, excuse me, I'm sorry. I wrote the letter before I sent him the script, because he sent me back a postcard that said, Dear Phil, do whatever you have to make it a movie, love Bill. And I thought, this is an unusual author. This is not someone who's overly protective of this work. And his wife later told me, well, Bill wrote the book because he wanted to inspire people. And so he wanted to see how it inspired you. He wanted to see what you were going to do with it. He'd already written his version. He wanted to see what your version would be. And I thought, that's a pretty evolved novelist.
And so how do you, because I remember reading about how William Goldman, for instance, adapted Stephen King's Misery. And I thought it was fascinating that Goldman would take out a marker pen and just go through the book and highlight the key passages and then come back and write it once he'd done that. What's your approach to something like that?
It's twofold. One, I had been talking about this project for 2 years before I got to write it. And so for 2 years, I was telling people a story. I was giving the book to a lot of friends. It was my sort of go-to Christmas and birthday present. But there were a lot of people, I remember on the set of In the Mood, if I had time, I'd sit down and I'd talk to the makeup crew and tell them the story. So for 2 years, I was verbally telling this story and refining the telling of it. So by the time I started to write, I pretty much knew how I was going to tell the story on the page. I knew what I was cutting out. I knew what parts needed work, because when you verbally tell a story to someone and you're looking at them, you can see their eyes roll back in their head when they're confused. Or you can, if they yawn, you can tell, okay, that's a boring part. You can also hear in your own voice when you're kind of speeding up to get past this point because it doesn't really make sense, and now we'll get to the part that does make sense.
Interesting.
And if you're alive to all those things, verbally telling the story, I think is a great way to refine it.
When a story has been in your head and a passion project, as this seemed to be for 2 years, and you've told it so many times, how do you then, when you're adapting it, find the perspective to under-explain it so much?
For me, it was about saying, and I have this theory that movies are about their endings. And I knew that I was going to take the father and son meeting and put it at the end. In the book, it's not a surprise. The son asks Shoeless Joe, would you let my father come play with you guys? And Shoeless Joe says, sure. And the father shows up 2/3 of the way through the movie, a surprise to neither the farmer nor to the reader. And I knew that was an emotional thing. I'm going to put that at the end. And I'm going to have him say, hey, Dad, you want to have a catch? And I'll have a catch. That doesn't happen in the book. Once I knew that, it was easy for me to go through the story and say, okay, these are the things I need to keep. These are the things I can jettison. These are the things I want to emphasize. These are the things I want to be subtle about so that the surprise works better. And having done that through the verbal telling of the story, I then took a copy of the book, put it on a stand next to my word processor, and was copying scene descriptions and dialogue right out of the book for the first draft. And I remember when I was very proud of how faithful that was to the book. And Scott Rudin, who was a producer at Fox at the time, said to me, congratulations, you've just written W.P. Kinsella's first draft. Now write yours. And that was great advice, because then I put the book aside and thought, okay, I'm not adapting a book, I'm writing a movie. And I know what I love about the book, but I'm going to make a movie about those things that I love about the book. And that freed me from being slavish to the book.
There was Danny Rubens published his first script of Groundhog Day. I recall this, and I remember reading that first script of Groundhog Day. And then he wrote the other half of that book is him explaining just how much he needed to strip away to make all of that work. And he credits Harold Ramis an awful lot with that. But there's clearly genius in the man there as well. I'm curious with you, though, who were the sounding boards to make that work? Because it's only when I sit and think about Field of Dreams, I realize how little you tell us. Because, you know, at one stage, it's a time travel movie, isn't it? But none of us ever think of it as a time travel movie. I barely think of it a baseball movie, to be fair.
Well, the sounding boards were Scott Rudin and Larry and Chuck Gordon. They were, and there was a woman named Sarah Colleton who worked for the Gordons at the time. They all loved the book, so I felt that I was in good hands sharing this with them. Also, Lindsay Duran, the woman at AFCO Embassy, even though she wasn't at Fox when I wrote it, I remember giving her the first draft where I had done what Kinsella did. I have Ray hear the voice once and go to his wife and say, I have to do this. I have to build this baseball field. And Lindsay was the one who pointed out to me, he's crazy. She said, it works in the book, but on screen, you're seeing what's supposed to look like real life. And that's insane. And I thought, good for you. I thought that was great criticism. And what it made me do is say to myself, okay, what would I do if I heard a voice? Because I'm not a believer in these things. Well, I would assume, I would know there's a rational explanation. It's kids with a radio or a sound truck on the highway. So I would hear it again, and I'd go, well, that's really weird. What's going on? I'd ask my wife, what is this? I'd hear it again. We have a scene in the movie that we shot that's cut out where he goes and has his hearing checked. And then finally he hears it again, and he sees a vision of this ball field. And I felt like, okay, that's like four or five repetitions. He can't deny it now. He has to accept the fact something's going on. Kinsella, when he read the script, said to me, you have one beat too many. You don't need that many beats. And he was right. We cut out the hearing exam. But that sense of what would I do really helped me write that character, because what I did was I kept saying, I have Ray continually say, I know this is crazy, but I know this is nuts, but I feel like I have to do this. You know, I think this, I'm afraid this is the last chance to be spontaneous. I saw my father not be spontaneous. I know it's crazy. Do you think I'm crazy? Yes, I think you're crazy. We say that probably a half dozen times so the audience doesn't have to. If we don't acknowledge that it's nuts, the audience is going to be going, what's wrong with these filmmakers? This is lunatic. So by having the character acknowledge it over and over again and say, oh, but I'm compelled, there's something in me that just makes me want to forget that it's unrealistic and it's nuts. I feel like I got to do this. And the wife, in a great act of love, says, if you feel you have to do it, then do it.
She's the key, isn't it? I've always found that she's absolutely the key, because yes. I mean, I'm sure I'm explaining things to you that you already know. It's just like, there are so many films I see where it's a wife character whose job is just to say no and don't do that. And she's absolutely the springboard. I mean, Amy Madigan is just brilliant in it, but she's absolutely the springboard to which the story, to my untrained eyes, wouldn't work without.
Absolutely right. And in fact, it's the moment when I fell in love with the book, which was page two, when he goes to her and says, I have to plow under our corn to build a baseball field so Shoeless Joe Jackson can come back. And she says to him, oh, love, if you feel you have to do it, then do it. And I thought, wow, I've never read that character before. I'm going to follow these two people. I want to see where they go.
I'm also fascinated just from the business side of this, of how smoothly it seemed to get in the end once it landed through Universal, through the studio system, because we on our side of the fence hear all sorts of horror stories. And out of curiosity, I went to look at what other films Universal were green lighting at the same time. And chief amongst them was Twins, like the highest of high concept movies of all time, which I think, if memory serves, was just pitched with three words, Schwarzenegger, DeVito, Twins. And then against it, you have an unpitchable movie, right. To my eyes. Right. I don't know how you reduce it in any way, really. Can you talk about that studio ecosystem? Because it sounds as if Larry and Chuck Gordon were pivotal to getting through that bit.
They were, as was a man named Tom Pollock, who was chairman of Universal at the time, and who just passed away this past year, which is very sad. He was a wonderful, wonderful man and a great champion of this movie. I mean, I used to say, truthfully, he's the guy who wrote the check, you know. We sent the script. You're right, it's unpitchable. We never tried to pitch them the story. Yeah. We simply gave people the book or the screenplay once the screenplay was written. Tom and all of his senior executives read the screenplay over one weekend. And on Monday morning, when they met, they all admitted to each other they had cried at the end. I think if one of them had not, that would have been sufficient to sink the boat. I think if one of them said, wait a second, I think so. It was a very fragile thing. And Tom said, I mean, Tom even said to me, this is the kind of movie you only greenlight if a voice speaks to you. He said, this is the lowest concept film I have ever heard of.
Interesting.
But he believed in it. He was moved by it, and he wanted it, and his the executives below him were all unanimous, and he said, let's do it. And he said to me, you can have whoever you want to star in this film. The budget will expand or contract accordingly. If you want to cast an unknown, you'll get a lot less money. If you want to cast a star, you'll get more money. It's really your call. He was very supportive about letting the creators flap their wings and see what we could do. He was great.
And so this presumably was even in the aftermath of In the Mood. And I don't think I'm breaking news to you that In the Mood opened and didn't set the box office alight. And I'm just kind of curious that, I mean, the whole era in which this film was made just seemed like, it's again, I'm coming back to an old cliche, it's just like the right moment. It almost feels like it could almost only have been adapted by you in your early 30s before you'd lived lots more life experiences and at the point where you were in your directorial career as well.
I think that's true. I mean, In the Mood opened in September, and I think, you know, and made lunch money. I mean, it was just, it was a flop. A month later, Universal made this deal. And I still am not sure why they didn't say, you know what, we really should get somebody else. But one of the executives there said to me, when I finished In the Mood, he said, what was the budget? I said, it was under 5 million. He said, you'll work forever. So they liked the fact that I had done something very economical. They knew from the screenplay that I had a take on this material that seemed to be valid. They it was a leap of faith. A voice spoke to them and they said, do it.
It seems a very strange inversion that you kind of did a low budget film where by the sounds of it, you had to fight to get everything you wanted and do all the traditional pushing things uphill. You get a studio film with I've done this podcast a lot, and it's one of the stories where I can hear as little studio resistance to a project going through once it was set up at Universal. Is that fair? I mean, was there any pushback you were coming up against?
I'll tell you what, there was one executive there who said, you have to explain the magic. Yeah. And I said, but I don't know where it comes from. I don't know who the voice is. I don't know how the time travel happens. And if I came up with an explanation, it would not be anywhere near as satisfying as no explanation at all.
Yeah.
And this one executive had a hard time with that, but everybody else was fine with it. There was another executive actually at Fox who said to me, you know, this ending where the guy meets his father is fantastic, but it only lasts like a minute or two. How about instead of Ray kidnapping the reclusive writer, he kidnaps his father? I said, so the father's alive? He goes, yeah, yeah. Then you get half the movie with the father and the son. I said, but the father's alive. I said, right. But instead of 1 minute at the end, you get 45 minutes. I said, but the father's alive. It's not that unusual to meet your living father. It's quite unusual to meet your dead father. You want to give that ending up? He said, yeah, because he gets half the movie could be he never quite understood. To his credit, when the movie opened, he wrote me a long handwritten letter saying, you were right, I was wrong, this is much better.
Oh, that's lovely.
That was really the only pushback we had, was those two people who didn't quite get the magic. Everybody else really did, which is a credit, I think, to the people who were at the studio at that time, Tom Pollock and his executives. You know, they made Do the Right Thing that year.
Yeah.
They had quite a good year, actually. That was an era when they were taking chances and making kind of bold films. And I will tell you that Lou Wasserman, who was chairman of Universal at the time, did not like this film. And he was unhappy that Tom had greenlit.
I mean, there's tiny little bit of me, and I say this as a huge fan of the film, which, you know, there's a tiny little bit of me that thinks the skeptics weren't wrong either. You know,
I agree. Completely agree.
It's binary, isn't it? It's like, if you don't get this, you're just not going to get it.
That's right. It works on a frequency. And if your internal tuning fork vibrates to that frequency, it can be very satisfying. And if it doesn't, it's just the stupidest, most ridiculous film. And it's the only thing I've ever done where when people criticize it, I don't feel bad. I don't take it personally. I get it. I everything that they say is right for them.
I mean, in terms of, if you want to know who the voice is, I can point you towards several extensive internet theories as to just who the voice is. I mean, you know, I'll send you some web links after this. But okay. I love a quote you gave at one point, which is where you said, everyone will be thrilled not to make Field of Dreams. I think that's attributed to you, just because it's such an easy thing to say no to. And then they said yes. And I'm still hugely grateful that they did. But at the point they said yes, what happens to you? Because all of a sudden you're making a bigger film, that the onus is on you, the focus is on you. And this whole bizarre thing of you're given the space to do it, but no safety net, from what I can see.
Exactly right. And that was the great existential dilemma that I was grappling with. I was in turmoil because they had said, okay, here's the budget you asked for. Here's the biggest star in Hollywood. Here's the crew that you asked for. Now go direct this movie that you've been shooting your mouth off about all these years. And I realized I have no excuses if this fails. My previous film, it was low budget. It was like, you know, we had a lot of constraints. I had excuses. I'd never done something without excuses. This would be the first time that I realized it's completely a test of me. It's completely about, can I do what I have been saying I can do? And I didn't know that I could. And I remember when I was leaving to go to the airport, the car picked me up to take me to the airport. And I'm in the car and I was having such a panic attack that I almost said to the driver, turn around, take me home, I'm not going. I really thought about it. I thought, let them sue me, it'll end my career, I don't care, I can't do this. I was terrified.
I appreciating if you don't want to answer this because it's a little bit personal, but I would you describe yourself as an anxious person? Is that generally your character?
No.
Just the sheer pressure of just this massive open door and being given exactly what you asked for.
That's right. And the pressure was the open door.
Yeah.
And so more than anything else.
But I've read in an interview before you say you talked about, you seriously thought about, oh, I won't do this. No, I can't do this. But I mean, it's a Hollywood, to us, to lots of us on the outside, it sounds a Hollywood story, really. That's part of the beauty of the building of the story. But how close was it? How close was it to asking that car to turn around? Was it a very, very deep unhappiness, perhaps the wrong word, but fear, maybe?
It was fear. I don't know how close I actually came to it, but I was having the conversation with myself. I went through in my head, we can turn around. This is what will happen. They're going to sue me. It'll be the end of my career. I really thought about all the repercussions of it. I'm delighted I didn't say that.
Yeah,
I will say
pleased.
This. When I got to the airport, I was flying with John Lindley, who was my cinematographer, and there were one or two other people, I think Bill Elvin, the assistant director. And that made me feel a lot better when I saw them. I felt like, oh yeah, right, I'm part of a company. I've got support around me. When we got to Iowa, there was the rest of the crew. There were my guys. Most of the crew had worked on In the Mood, and that made me feel better. And Amy Madigan's on the flight, and that made me feel better. It's like, The people kind of pumped me up just being around them. I didn't feel quite so alone and terrified because I realized they all know a lot more about filmmaking than I do. They've worked on so many movies. I'll be okay. I just have to trust the script.
And did the geography help as well? Because your next film you'd make in Hollywood, but this one geographically was, I mean, a far distance away from a Hollywood executive.
Well, the geography actually worked a little against me in that I was away from home. I didn't have my dog. I didn't have I wasn't sleeping in my own bed. All the sort of comforts of home were taken away. Iowa is a lovely place, but it's not home for me. It's not a place that I go to and say, I belong here. I do feel a little bit of fish out of water there. But the people really helped me kind of get back on track and focus.
You mentioned just before that you were given almost carte blanche by Universal to cast anyone you wanted in this film. Right. And you've talked in the past about the story of casting Kevin Costner and the doubts whether he'd be interested because he was just coming off Bull Durham. But I'm just kind of curious, what extreme did you entertain other casting choices? Was there a thought in your head, actually, we could go really small and off radar? Or was it always you needed someone with a bit of clout, even though his star was only just bubbling up at that point?
I do think we all felt we wanted a star. And we had made a list of other people of his generation. There were some very good names on the list. We got a call from Universal at this point. This was probably November of 87. And they said, Good Morning America is going to open in January, or maybe it was December, and it's going to be the biggest hit of the year. And Robin Williams has read your script and he wants to play this role.
Good Morning Vietnam, yeah.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Good Morning America. That's right. I'm in the UK. Good Morning America, I think, is the morning show. Is that right?
Yes.
Right, got you.
Sorry.
They
said, Good Morning Vietnam is going to be this huge hit. Robin's going to be the biggest star in Hollywood. He wants to do the movie. And I'm a huge Robin Williams fan.
Well,
I worship him. But I thought, no, that's not for this movie. This is about a guy who's never done a crazy thing in his whole life. Robin hears voices. You know, it changes the experience of the movie if he's the guy doing a crazy thing, as opposed to somebody who's completely sensible and would never do something crazy. And I felt really strongly about that. And Larry Gordon said to me, Are you willing to walk away? Are you willing to say if the studio insists on Robin, you're not going to do the movie? And I said, no, I'm not willing to say that. But he said, all right, then you have to have a meeting with Robin. And I said, okay. And they started to negotiate his deal before he wouldn't meet. His agency wouldn't let him meet without a deal. And this was a couple of weeks. And I said to Larry one day, this deal they're negotiating, after the meeting, I can still get out of it, right? And he said, not really. He said, he can get out of it, but I don't think you can. And I said, well, I don't know what to do. I think he's wrong for the movie. As if the universe, the tumblers clicked into place and the universe opens itself up for a second, an executive at Universal ran into Kevin Costner at dinner that night, said to him, hey, we've got a script you might be interested in, and gave him the script. And the next day, Kevin called this guy and said, I really like this. I understand you're out to another actor, and I don't want to take a job away from another actor, but if it ever becomes available, call me. So they told me that. Then I called Larry Gordon and said, okay, I'm now willing to say, if the studio insists on Robin, I'm not doing the movie. And it,
understood.
It was a weird thing to feel, because Robin is one of the great geniuses of our time. He's a great comedian, he's a great actor. But boy, I felt just so strongly, I really, really want Jimmy Stewart. You know, I really want someone who's just not out of the middle of the road for a character. So Larry said to me, okay, he said, I'm going to get you out of this Robin thing. And he said, you put your voicemail on, you do not answer your phone for a whole day till I call you. And I said, okay. And I hung up, and immediately the phone starts ringing. And I was getting calls from Universal and from CAA and all these people. For a day, that phone was ringing off the hook. The next day, Larry called me and he said, all right, I got you out of it. And he said, there's blood on the floor, but I got you out of it. And I said, you know, I changed my mind. I want Robin. He said, fuck you. I want Spielberg.
Just imagine if that executive had bumped into, I don't know, Burt Reynolds or someone like that and given him the script. I mean,
exactly.
just those little bits of fate.
It's complete fate. That's exactly right.
You mentioned you wanted Jimmy Stewart there. I suspect it's internet tittle-tattle that an offer went into him, or he was sounded out about the film. Was there anything in that for the role of Moonlight Graham?
Yeah, I offered him the role of Moonlight Graham. And I've heard two different versions of what happened. His agent said to me later, Jimmy didn't want to play a character who dies. And I said, oh, I wish I'd known that, because he doesn't really die. You know, the other version I heard is that Lou Wasserman didn't want his old friend and client to do this role in this stupid movie that he didn't like, and that he told him not to. Now, I don't know which one is true. I've been told by people at Universal that Lou had said to Jimmy, don't do it.
And do you know if he ever saw it in the end?
I don't know.
That would be quite something.
Yeah. So we got him in the movie with a little clip of Harvey, you know, in the
phone. Yes, I saw. So, there's much of the pressure, and appreciating you've told some of these stories before, not least on that DVD, of this film appears to be agricultural. that the, I mean, there's no easy way around that. There's not that many people I can talk to about agriculture on film, about getting corn the right height, and stories of you having to paint the field because the grass was dead. Just the one other side of it, though, again, just going back to the film business side, is the other ticking clock against it appeared to be a film called Revenge. That Kevin Costner was going off to make with Tony Scott straight afterwards. And this bit of the story tends to be told quite lightly. And I'm curious what kind of pushback you were getting from the Revenge team on this. Were you feeling a really intense pressure that they wanted their leading man released by the time that your grass had grown, for want of a better way of putting it?
So much so that we had to contractually guarantee that Kevin would leave no later than August 15th. We were scheduled to wrap August 1st. So we had 2 weeks of breathing room, but Kevin would say to me, that's the only vacation time I get to spend with my family between these two films. So I'm really hoping you can wrap by August 1st. But August 15th, he was gone. And the pressure that creates is that there's a thing called a completion bond, which is a kind of insurance for a film that guarantees the financiers, the financing entities, that the film will be finished. And if you have a stop date, that means that the completion bond company, if they fear that you're going to go over your stop date, they can come in and take over the film. And they would be on the set saying, you get one take of this shot. You don't need that shot. Okay, move on, next shot. One take, move on. Because they're going to guarantee you will be finished by this time. That was the sword of Damocles hanging over our heads. And Larry Gordon, I remember one day during the shoot when I was feeling particularly down, and somebody must have called him and said, boy, Phil is really carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. He called me up and he said, listen, do you still believe in the script? I said, yes. He said, well, you're shooting the script. Just trust it. Just keep shooting the script. As we got closer to the end, he called me one day and said, I know I told you to shoot the script. Now I'm going to tell you something else. Shoot the schedule. He said, I've never had a movie taken over by a completion bond company, and I'm not going to have one now. You got to finish on schedule.
I'm just double checking the name. It's Dwyer Brown, isn't it, who plays John Kinsella? And I know that he wrote his memoir, really, of making Field of Dreams. And he talked there about how he was contracted for 3 days and ended up hanging around for a couple of weeks for agricultural reasons. And I mean, appreciating the stories are told of the corn having to be certain heights and never being the right height at the right time. Can you just take us into the human being side of it? What were the meetings like the night before, for instance, where you've got this stuff you need to shoot the following day and the grass just isn't behaving?
Early on, we knew this was a problem because there was the worst drought in 50 years. So the production manager and the first AD and I changed the schedule. We said, we're going to move all the corn scenes to the end of the schedule, which is dangerous because you want to keep interior scenes at the end of the schedule so that if at any point when you're shooting, it rains, you can just pull one of those scenes up and say, okay, tomorrow, so it's going to rain tomorrow. So instead of being on the field, we're going to shoot the feed sewer tomorrow. Well, we moved all of the interior scenes up to delay the corn as much as possible, shooting the corn as much as possible, which meant that by the time we got to the field to shoot the corn, it had grown because we'd irrigated and trucked in water, but we had no rain cover. If it rained, we had nothing else to shoot. And of course, at that point, it started to rain. And we had these great Midwest lightning storms that we just shut down for, you know, a good part of a day while it rained. So the schedule was creaking. It was starting to sort of creak under the weight of what we were doing. And we were a few days over, then we were a week over. We couldn't go 2 weeks over. We came close to it. I don't remember how close we came to it, but we came very close to that stop date, the contractual stop date.
I should check. Did Kevin Costner get his holiday?
Not much of one. And I remember when we got the last shot, I went over to him and I said, I owe you such an apology. I'm so sorry. I know what this means. And he said, No, we went over for all the right reasons. You know, we had to get it.
There's a shot early in the film which goes to just quite how unfussy the way you chose to shoot this film is. And it's when he hears the voice and you ground the camera and he walks out of shot. And early on, I just like, it sounds the most simple thing. I just like, I've not seen that. No, that, really? That goes against. Yeah, I hadn't really seen someone with almost the confidence in a film at that point, just to keep the camera still and just trust us to let the camera walk out of shot. Can you talk about your approach there? Because there's such a light hand on moments like that. And I just always think that if it had got any heavier, it might just have tipped this just a little bit off kilter.
I always felt like every moment was it was like walking through a minefield, that every moment you could step on, if you move just a little bit to the side, you could detonate a mine. That moment, I actually did that a couple of times in the film. There's a scene in the kitchen where they're both walking through and they're both out of the frame. I love that. I just love it visually, but also in this moment that you're talking about, what we're really saying is, hey, there's something here. It looks like just a cornfield, but there's something here. Come back and see what's there. And that was one of the moments when we were up on a crane. There was lightning in the distance. And I realized, I'm the highest object for 50 miles and I'm on a large piece of metal. I don't know that this is smart. And we did a few more takes and the lightning was coming closer and no one was saying anything. So I figured, well, these guys, they work on crews all the time. They would know if there was danger. So we finally got a take I liked and I said, let's print that, let's come down. And the whole crew said, thank God, oh my God, I couldn't believe you stayed up there. We had courage to stay up there. Courage. You got to tell me that I'm risking my life. I'm not doing it intentionally.
There's a lovely story that Dexter Fletcher told about directing the film Eddie the Eagle, which is a film I'm really, really fond of. I think that's got such humanity and heart to it. And he was looking to cast at just a small cameo role in it. And he wanted Christopher Walken because he wanted to cast someone in the role in that film who the audience would instantly feel brings something without anything having to be explained. Please talk to me about Burt Lancaster and please talk to me about sitting round and Burt Lancaster telling you stories.
Well, first I'll say I got to work with Dexter on Band of Brothers and he's a wonderful guy and a really good actor.
Yeah, and a great director.
And a terrific director.
Yeah.
Burt Lancaster, this is one of the great thrills. You know, it's one of the privileges you have when you do these films. You get to every once in a while touch the golden age, you know? And I wanted someone who could believably have been an athlete in his youth. And he was an athlete in his youth. He was a circus acrobat. And we offered him the part. We heard from his agent that he accepted it. And I would meet him for the first time at the read-through. We had rented a rehearsal space and had a big table set up and the cast convened. And I meet Bert. And he said to me, I want to wear a mustache and I want to wear a little hat. And I said, okay, why? And he said, I don't want to look like Burt Lancaster. I said, all right. So I brought him into the room with all the other actors, introduced him around. We sat, we started to read the script out loud. And the first time somebody said the name Dr. Graham, he said, no, not Graham, Graham. And they said, Graham. He goes, no, not Graham, Graham, like Graham Cracker. And they said, Graham, because that's it. Now, none of us could hear the difference, but he did. And we realized this is a quirky person and he's a person from another era and they work differently. And in every scene that we did, Bert would say to me, I'm going to turn away and then I'll stop and turn back. He had this move that he had done all his career and it worked for him and he was going to work it into every scene that he could. He was, I will say, difficult. And in fairness to him, he was in failing health. It was hot. is wearing this heavy woolen outfit, and he was surrounded by young, healthy people who were out there in shorts and t-shirts and throwing baseballs around. And I think that was just killing him, because he used to be that virile young man, and he no longer was. And I think it put him in a very bad psychological place. So he was pretty tough.
Do you mind me asking, without wishing to go gossip columnist, which I'm not trying to do, when you say difficult, can you talk to that a little bit? And again, how that affects you as on your biggest film at that point?
He wanted to do things his way. And there's an example. At one point I said to him, when he says the line, Kevin says, "Oh my God, you can't go back." He says, "That's all right." He goes, "Thank you." And Doc says, "No, son, thank you." He kind of threw that line away. He said, "No, son, thank you." And I said, "Gee, Bert, let's do it one more. Can you just give me a pause there? Just let it sink in for a second." He really kept doing it without the pause, without giving that line any emphasis. And finally, I just said, "I'm sorry, I need you to take a pause there." And he turned to Amy and he said, "I've just been chastised by Alden." And I thought it was a funny way to describe it, but then he did the take the way I wanted it to. You always had the feeling that anything could set him off. Now, I never saw him go nuts, but I felt like there was a hair trigger, that he was in a bad mood, and I didn't want to see what would happen if we pushed it too hard. So we finished his work. He went back to LA, and in the editing room, I cut out part of one scene that he's in. And when it was time to loop, he was going to come in to the looping studio and he was going to see that I'd cut out some of his lines. And I was worried that that would put him in a bad mood again. So the night before he came in, I rented Sweet Smell of Success and I ran Sweet Smell of Success at home. And the next morning when Bert walked into the studio, before he even said, "Oh," I said, "Bert, I watched Sweet Smell of Success last night. Man, that's a tough film. I love how tough that film is." And he said, "Oh yes, a tough film. I was only going to produce it. They weren't going to let me produce it unless I starred it. I had to star in it." And we talked about the film and he was very proud of it. And he was very happy that I liked it. And we're about to loop the scene that I had cut some lines out of. And he said, "Just a second. I see you cut some lines out of this scene." And I said, "Oh, here it comes." And he said, "I see why you did that. That's a good cut. It's a good cut." And I breathed a big sigh of relief. And we had a lovely morning together. He was easy and warm and friendly. I remember, actually this was on the set, I remember asking him about the scene in with Deborah Carr on the beach the World War II film.
From Here to Eternity. Yeah.
Here to Eternity. And he said, "Ah, Deborah Carr, she was a fucking angel."
Did he like the film in the end, out of interest?
I don't know.
And apart from those moments that you were describing, would you describe the shoot of this one as a happy one? Was it other than that relative, apart from the pressures you were under?
For many people, it was happy. For me, it wasn't. I say that with some embarrassment because that was just my own insecurity. And I had a lot of it. But every day I felt like, damn, I'm not getting it. I'm not getting what I had in my head. And every night at dailies, I'd watch the dailies and I'd think, didn't get it. And I would go home and just feel horrible. And I had nightmares. One night I dreamt that people were coming at me with knives. And I said to them, and I'm backing away and they're coming forward. And I said, "Who are you?" And in unison, they said, "We love the book." I had that dream. I had many dreams like that. I dreamed where people were dying on the set. I just was so anxious and so insecure about what I was doing. And Larry called one day and said, "Look, you know, when you're shooting an action film, you go to the dailies and you say, okay, that explosion is good. You should have come. You say that joke is funny. What you're doing, you can't tell from the dailies. You won't know until the film is cut and the music is in and the print is cleaned up. So just trust the fact you're shooting the script."
I read one or two interviews with people who've directed very special effects heavy movies, and they talk about the fact that they only get to see their film glued together and working at the very last moment when all of those shots are dropped in. It strikes me with this one that for the ending to work, all the ingredients have to build to it. And I wonder what it's like looking at that piecemeal. Was there a feeling in you that it wasn't quite working?
There's a big feeling in me. I thought every night, and I remember saying to someone one day, they said, do you think it's bad? I said, no, I think it's okay. And that's a failure for this material. You know, for this material to be okay is just, I just shoot myself. That's not why we're here. And my mood affected other people. And I know that Kevin didn't like it, that I was sort of morose.
Yeah.
It bugged him. And John Lindley, my cinematographer, who I've worked with before and since, said to me one day, you got to cheer up. And I said, you know, I only have enough energy to either do my job or pretend I'm enjoying it. I can't do both. And he said, nobody wants to hear that from you. And I thought, wow, that was like a slap in the face that I needed. And I then tried to pretend I was having a good time. I don't think I was very convincing. I'm not that good an actor, but I think I got a little better anyway.
But has that run through all of your directing career? Because you've been fairly open about the fact you don't get the joy from that part of the process.
I got it more each successive time.
Yep.
Sneakers was more fun now. I was sleeping in my own bed during Sneakers, mostly in the night. And Some of All Fears, I had a wonderful time on it. And even though that was a huge movie with lots of special effects, I'd gotten to learn how it works. You know, I'd gotten to learn more how you can fix things.
So the irony of this to me is going through some of the pre-interviews you did almost on Field of Dreams. You talk about how you can't go into a project like this with pessimism. Those are your words. You know, I've written that in my notes here. And then to hear you tell this story, it's just like it's almost like there's a little paradox, a human paradox at the heart of that.
It is. I mean, it's a confidence game.
Yeah.
It's not unlike, remember the old, we call it Arrowhead water coolers. You have a big bottle of water gets delivered to your house and you turn it upside down to put it on the dispenser. But in the act of turning it upside down, if you do it slowly, the water is all going to flow out. You have to have total confidence and just go, boom, and not spill a drop. And that's kind of like what directing is. You just have to have that confidence that it's going to be okay. You're going to do the best you can, and it will be okay. And things that you thought you failed at can often be fixed in the editing room. And they can be fixed with music, and they can be fixed by cutting it out. I mean, the worst scenes in the movies all get cut out.
Yeah.
And it's not an accident that you're able to cut out the bad scenes, that you don't need them to tell a story. It's because you don't need them. That's why they're bad.
You relied towards the end of the shoot on, the infamous scene with the catch on natural light. That I think it's the twilight hour or something you call it in interviews you've done before. What I hadn't appreciated is how piecemeal the shooting of that moment at the end was. That again, you've talked about the extensive logistics of getting all those cars in a line and having, you know, people blinking their lights while the cars were stationary, and how, you know, it took you had three shots and all of that to get there. But the bit with two people having a catch, to us on the outside, that's the kind of thing you'd shoot in an hour. And yet that was the one that spanned several nights.
There were quite a few. We shot a lot of the movie at Magic Hour.
Yeah.
Which came about because the first week of shooting, John Lindley and I were driving home from the set each day at Magic Hour. And we said, wow, the sky, the light is gorgeous. Why aren't we shooting now? So we then looked at a whole bunch of scenes in the movie and said, let's shoot these at Magic Hour. When Kevin and Amy, when they finished building the field, they're on a little picnic blanket looking out at the field, and it says, it's, you know, it's kind of beautiful. this, I think the another time when he hears the second voice, there's a whole bunch of scenes we decided, let's do these at Magic Hour, which only lasts 15 minutes. So you figure out, I'm just going to break up this scene over 4 or 5 days, 6 days, 7. I forget how many days we shot that final scene where he meets his father. And it was just, you have enough time to get like one piece. And it's also a confidence game, because if you shoot too early, you lose that, the magic in that light. If you shoot too late, you don't get exposure. So you have this narrow window and you get set up and you're ready to shoot. The actors are there, the crew is there, you're ready to go. And I look over at John and he goes, not yet. And it's getting darker and darker. And I'm looking at him saying, come on, because I want to have time to do more than one take, you know. I want to have a couple of takes. Finally, I'd look over at him and he'd say, you want to shoot this? You better do it right now. Roll, action. And maybe you get two takes out of it. But it's a very narrow window. You're also relying on the light being the same night after night, which it generally is close enough. But we did one night, the scene of them on the picnic blanket, I couldn't schedule that on two nights. I had to do that there. So I shot it this way. I have them on the picnic blanket. There's a camera on them, positioned on them there. They stand up. We had a second camera positioned for, they stand up into that shot. So it was like a live TV kind of approach. We shot the whole scene in one take, but with two cameras getting these two different angles.
And so when you were, when the time came for you to call the final shot on the movie and you were going to take it back to Los Angeles and edit it, did you feel you had it? Did you feel you got what you're after? Was there something there that was something you weren't allowed to do, or taking the confidence aside, was there anything physically that was missing?
No, there was nothing physically that I can think of. I think we had gotten, on paper, we had gotten it all.
Yeah.
And we had stayed, probably a week, almost 2 weeks over schedule to get that. I did feel like we had it all, and I felt like it wasn't great.
Yeah.
And not for any lack of actors, I thought that I just didn't get it. For one thing, I had a much more expressive use of the camera in my head, and it turns out I didn't have the chops to do it. I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I'm glad I didn't, because I think that very simple approach,
the stillness,
was
the stillness.
Right, was for the movie. And we came back to the editing room, and every director will tell you that the first time you see the editor's assembly of the film, it's, you want to just kill yourself because nothing's right. And that's no offense to any editor. It's just the nature of the beast. It's, you haven't had a chance to massage any of the scenes. You're just seeing kind of a stringing together, and it's, oh my God, you want to die.
Was that so 3 hours or something of that ilk?
It's probably 222 and a half, something like that. So it wasn't the length so much as just not one scene was cut the way I would cut it. And some of the choices were different than I'd have made. So I said to the editor, tell you what, I don't think I can do this the normal way, which is I'll give you some notes. I'll come back in a few days and look at it again. Then I'll give you some more notes. I said, let's take the first scene and just fine cut the first scene, make the first scene perfect. And when we got that perfect, we're going to look at the second scene and make that perfect. And then we're going to do the third. So I never looked at the whole film again until I had fine cut each scene. Then we looked at the movie. I could see the movie, and it had problems, but I was no longer distracted by that's the wrong take, or that pause isn't long enough, or that's too much of a pause, or I don't like the inflection here. All of the things that you try to fix in each scene were fixed. And now you could sit back and look at the whole film and go, okay, it's slow here. This isn't clear. This part moves a little too quickly. Let's open that up. And then I felt like, okay, we're getting it. And what's nice is that every day it gets better. Yeah. What I love about the editing room, every day it gets better. Writing it doesn't. Some days you go backwards writing, you make it worse. But in the cutting room, it's wonderful.
But yet tonally, this, again, to use the word again, this is such a fragile film that even when you're using humor, which you do a few times in the movie, that there's, it strikes me that if you overuse that humor, you almost let the air out of the balloon when you're asking your audience to take such a leap of faith. Was that ever something you were coming up against in the edit room, or had those problems sort of been resolved by that point?
No, there were a couple of scenes we cut out that were jokes.
Yeah.
Just didn't need them, and it felt superfluous, and it felt like what it was, which was my own insecurity and wanting to have something to get a laugh. It became pretty clear. Look, the movie's about how a guy meets his father again.
Yeah.
And so, and it's not clear to the audience, but that was the through line for us. And I had a philosophy, which was, this will never be a fast cut movie, yep, but it should be a tightly cut movie, meaning we should never give the audience time to sit back and think. Because if they do, they're going to say, hey, this doesn't make sense. I want there always to be a surprise around every corner. And so it's not fast, but it's tight. The storytelling is tight. It's consistently, the ball is being consistently moved forward. And I think that really worked for us.
Did you test it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And that fascinates me, how you put something like this in front of a test audience. And I've not put any work before a test audience, so I come at this quite naive. But what kind of response were you getting then? Because again, the cliche is test audiences get nothing, can kind of dumb it down a little bit.
The first test screening, for which I was extremely nervous, and Chuck Gordon and I went out for sushi before that and had a lot of sake to calm our nerves. And it was in a little screening room at the Universal lot, and 100 people file in, and we're sitting in the back, and they were liking the movie. We could tell they were liking the movie. In fact, we could tell they were kind of really liking it. And towards the end, when he says, oh my God, it's my father, I saw a woman two rows in front of me start to weep so convulsively that I got out of my seat. I was about to just go over to her and put my hand on her shoulder and say, it's just a movie. And I recognized her. She worked at the studio's marketing department, and she had seen the film the week before. And I thought, wow, someone who's seen it twice now is this moved. I think this is really going to work. And then in the very last scene, it stopped working. And you could feel something didn't work. And the lights come up, people fill out their cards, and a focus group is formed, about 15 people. And the facilitator said, so what did you think? And everybody couldn't wait to say, this movie is so cruel. He doesn't tell him, you're my father. Because the line at that point was, hey, you want to have a catch. Not, hey, Dad, you want to have a catch. It was, hey, you want to have a catch. Because I felt it's important for these two men to know the relationship as father and son, but never say it. Just like no one can ever say, hey, we can't cross this line. You know, just all these rules are unspoken. But I thought it was clear that, well, it wasn't clear. The audience didn't know that they knew. And I'd shot it in a way that when Ray introduces his daughter to the ball player, he says, Karen, this is my, and the ball player gives him a look. And he goes, this is John. I thought it was clear. They both understand it's my father, but you can't say it. The audience didn't get it. And so we went back in the cutting room. We said, well, okay, we have to loop the word dad in there. And the next time the scores went through the roof. So for me, that was the perfect example of what test screenings are for. And for me, it's only about one thing. It's not what they like or what they don't like or what they want. It's just about, did they understand what we're doing? That's all I want to know.
You said in your response to the story that you can never quite have the same response that you had to when you read the book for the first time. The ending can't hit you anywhere near enough. And you in the same way. And you used an example there of the woman in the screening room who'd seen it before, and that ending hit her more. I'm one of those who the ending hits harder because I know it's coming now. And I was always curious was it in Japan it was promoted, where the ending was written on the poster? I think there was one territory where it was just laid out.
Twice
on the poster. Twice on the poster.
It says, at end of movie, meets his dead father. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I said, why would you do that? And they said, no, it's very good, very good.
I have a theory with films. This is as sycophantic as I get, and I stand by every word, that sometimes you have to watch a film once, because then every time afterwards you're going to love it. And so you have to watch it the first time where you like it, and then you realize when you go back, I'm absolutely going to love it. Do you get any sense from that, from the ending of the story, that because you know what it's building to, it's doubly powerful?
I never thought of that. I always assumed that it's the surprise that creates this wellspring of emotion. But
it's the affirmation.
It's amazing. That's amazing.
That one single word. I would bet that quite a lot of people in that screening room got it. That they knew it was the dad, but they needed the affirmation.
Right.
They needed the dad. They needed them basically to say I love you, or to recognize and to acknowledge. Rather than pent it up. I'm a nobody on the other side of the planet, but that's how I always saw that.
I bet you're right. You know, the...
Send my invoice in then. That's that, belatedly.
I saw the film a lot with audiences because I needed to. The experience of making the film had been so emotionally trying that I got a lot out of sitting in the audience and seeing it through their eyes. And I always felt like that was what made it so emotional for me, is that I could feel the emotion in the room.
Yeah.
And I could feel that they were getting it. But I will admit that every time I see it, I tear up at the end. And I always tell myself,
by very definition, everybody's favorite film, they have to have watched at least twice. Nobody's favorite film is on a first watch. Apart from you, you've broken my rule.
E.T.
Is it Xanadu?
No, it's E.T.
E.T.
I loved E.T. so much that I said to myself, and it was such a perfect experience that I said to myself, I'm not going to watch this again. And it's odd. It's like, I will someday.
Yeah.
But I saw it the weekend it opened. And that experience was so purely emotional and 100% satisfying.
Yeah.
That I wanted to keep that purity in a weird way. I'll see it again someday, but
I sort of felt the same way with E.T. And then I watched it with my kids.
Oh,
and then
well, that's
that lifts it again. The great ones become favorites after more than one viewing. That's my hokey theory, and I'm kind of sticking to it. And I'll edit out of this podcast all of your dissent on that particular.
It's not hokey at all. Because there are films that I can watch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And love them just as much every time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that. Appreciating I'm running slight, I've run over. So I'm just going to gabble through just one or two little things, if that's possible. I'm just curious on you as a storyteller. I mean, clearly the fact that you'd authored the script and you knew this from the start and you were telling people the story for 2 years before you got a script together. I want to go back to that thing about keeping the whole thing so small. Because I've seen a film that you've made, for instance, where you've nearly killed Ben Affleck on screen with a nuclear bomb. So it's not as if that storytelling sensibility is the only one in your locker. But right throughout the process, as someone who's told me before, when we've talked about sneakers before, the whole idea of the film gets worse as you shoot it, and then it gets better as you edit it, as you said that. Was there any chance that smallness in the midst of it was being lost at any point, even on the worst days?
That's a really good question. I don't remember feeling that. I do remember feeling, because I thought the actors were all doing a really good job. And the actor, as you know, Kevin said to me one day, he said, don't worry, he says, I'm idiot proof. Meaning I couldn't screw his performance up. And there were days when it may have felt to him like I was trying. And there are days when he was very malleable and other days when he would just sort of stand his ground and say, no, I'm going to do it this way. And I appreciate that tremendously because his instincts were really, really good. There's a scene towards the end when he sees... when Tim Busfield says, where did all these players come from? And all of a sudden, Tim gets funny. It's funny there. Kevin was uncomfortable being in that shot because his character wasn't feeling anything funny. And I was playing it for a joke. And we kind of worked out a way to do it. But when I look at that scene now, I see Tim being really funny and Kevin on the other side of the frame looking off as if to say, I'm not in that shot, I'm in this shot. And it makes me laugh every time I see it because he's protecting his character.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and he was right to do it. Nobody was veering off course. I mean, everybody had a pretty strong through line for what they were doing. And so I didn't feel that was the problem. I felt the problem was how I was shooting the movie. I thought it was very pedestrian. And I know now it wasn't pedestrian. It was appropriately clean.
So my ultimate dim question in the midst of all of this, and I do pride myself on my dim questions. When did you know?
Oh, I knew when we showed it to James Horner.
When he left the room?
And then I think it was the next night is when we had that first test screening. And this woman who had seen the film the week before was crying. That's when I started to really get it. But, and then you start to have screenings and people say nice things and the press, a lot of the reviews are very good. But opening weekend, the film opened on a Friday night and we all went to this big theater in Westwood. And it was the best audience we'd had yet. They were fantastic. And they laughed louder at the funny parts and they screamed louder when the little girl falls off the bleachers and they cried louder at the end. And on Friday night in Los Angeles, if it's the first night of a movie, you can always tell the filmmakers because they're the people standing outside the door of the theater watching the audience come out. And we were outside the, and we had a lot of friends who were there that night who were coming over and congratulating us. We felt really good. And I noticed a young man, thin, pale young man in a windbreaker, just standing kind of in the doorway watching us. And I could tell he wanted to come over and say something, but we were with people we knew. And finally, the crowd has thinned out. We're just about to leave. And he comes over to me and he said to me, excuse me, you had something to do with this film? I said, yes. He said, when I woke up this morning, I didn't know how I was going to have the strength to get through another day. And your film gave me that. And then he walked away. And I was so taken aback. I wish to God I had stopped him and said, wait, tell me what's going on. I had the feeling, this was late 80s, maybe he had AIDS. I just had a feeling that there was something really sad in his life. But to say that, to first of all, to be that down and go to the movie says something about you want to find something, you want to find a way back up. And that the movie moved him to the extent that he had to come and tell me that. I've never forgotten that guy. That's about as good as it gets, I think.
And when, beyond that, outside of when did you know in the moment, when did you become aware what it's become?
That's a great question. I don't know that there was a moment. Certainly we would hear from people. I got mail from around the world. It was care of the studio, but it would come to me. I don't know anything about baseball, but I haven't talked to my father in 20 years. And after I saw your film, I called him up and said, let's go to this movie together. We got a lot of that.
Do you still?
Not so much now, but when the movie came out, certainly for that first year or two, we got a lot of those letters. There was a man in England, was a journalist. We opened the film at the Brighton Film Festival, and a journalist walked over to me in the lobby afterwards. He was a big, burly guy with a Scottish accent, and I can't do a Scottish accent. I wish I could because the line is great. He said to me, I hate baseball. I hate sentiment. Greatest fucking movie I've ever seen. And then many years later, we showed the film in Hanoi. I was with a group from the Academy. And an old Vietnamese woman said, I never knew that Americans cared about their families the way Vietnamese people do. This movie has changed my whole view of America. And it's things like that that make you say, that's the Oscar. That's what you want. You know,
I mean, I should puncture all of this celebration of the film by saying I've got at least one child who thinks it's a load of nonsense and total rubbish and thinks I'm entirely wrong. And by the look on your face, that is absolutely music to your ears.
He's not wrong. He's absolutely right. It's like,
for God's sake, don't tell him that.
No, this movie works on a certain frequency, and it's not a failure in a person if their internal tuning fork doesn't vibrate to that frequency. It's just we're all different. If the movie doesn't vibrate for you, it is stupid. It's senseless. It makes no sense at all. It's ridiculous. I totally understand when people say they don't like this movie. It's the only thing I've ever done where when people say they don't like it, I don't get defensive or insulted. I go, yeah, I completely get it. I could easily be that person.
Are you one of those people on the internet comment boards then that's just criticizing it? Is that you, secretly? you can be our secret.
They don't need my help. They're very good at it. And I truly believe this. They're not wrong.
At the point we're recording this, I do want to quickly bring this up, because if I've got this right, you were a little bit alien to two things that have just happened just with regards to the legacy of the film, in that there's been a game that took place on the field next to the field, a Major League Baseball game that I saw that Kevin Costner was at, but you weren't. And also, I believe there's a television series of the film of the book that's now been greenlit again. I didn't see your name in the credits of that. Have you had any involvement in either of those?
No. And I, you know, the game was supposed to be played last year, but it was postponed because of COVID. And we weren't invited last year either, Larry Gordon and I, or this year. The TV series I knew nothing about till it was announced. So that's a weird feeling.
My questions right throughout this have been the human being at the heart of it. And I'm just curious, and I understand if you don't want to go there, but I mean, does it sting a little bit, the fact that you...
Sure, it does. And you know, going to the game, I'm not sure I would have gone to the game. If the Dodgers had been playing, I might have gone, because of my team. I didn't really care that much about a White Sox-Yankees game. It was a very, very good game. It was a great game to watch. But the TV series thing is stung, and I'm trying to sort of rise above it, and just say, you know what, Bill Kinsella said he wanted to see where I would go with the screenplay. So maybe I should be magnanimous and say, let's see where they go. But, it's odd. I mean, in the announcement of the series, somebody who was an executive at Universal Television said, the only person we could trust this project with is name that producer. Is that really the only person? But this is Hollywood. You know, there's. I talked to Larry the next day, and he said, this has been my argument for 60 years. You can't look for justice or fairness in this town. It's not what they do.
And I mean, in terms of crowning glories for a career, however, whilst I wouldn't necessarily suggest being episode 200 guest on a podcast necessarily ranks alongside a television series being made without your knowledge, and a game going on without, that you didn't get an invite to twice by the sounds of it. I am really, really curious of the legacy of this, because we would not, I'm one of those, I know nothing about baseball, and we've had this chat off camera before. I know nothing about it, and if you were writing a demographic plan for who this film would appeal to, I mean, it's just not me. You know, I still know now. I went to one baseball game and they played James Earl Jones's monologue from the start, although it's always the Gabby Hoffman one that really chokes me up, but that's a whole, you know, I just think her delivery of that is so wonderful. I just want to close with just a really simple question, really. Have you any idea what you've done?
I don't think of it as what I've done, because it's really Bill Kinsella.
I'm sorry to interrupt, and I'm really sorry to be rude about this, but right throughout this interview you've gone out of your way to give credit to everybody involved, and I hugely respect that, and genuinely I think not enough people do that. Have you any idea what you've done?
I do. I think I have a clear idea. I didn't screw it up.
No. No.
And it would have been very easy to. John Lindley actually said, you know, there were 1,000 decisions, any one of which could have sunk this thing, and you got them right. And I'm very proud of that. It's not the cinematic achievement that I had in my head, but in terms of storytelling, it did exactly what I hoped it would do. And that was the lesson I learned that allowed me to direct again, which is you could say to yourself, as I did, I would reshoot every shot of this movie tomorrow. I was not satisfied with any moment, but the movie delivered exactly what I hoped it would deliver. It moved people the way the book moved me, and that was my goal. And that was the lesson I learned, is it's not about, is this shot the same thing that you had in your head? It's about, what does the audience feel?
I think it's, my heart is utterly on my sleeve with this one. I think it's a hugely special film, and I just can't congratulate and thank you enough. I mean, for all of it sounding like it was a series of coincidences and mistakes and just people bumping into each other at the wrong time, may I just say that I'm glad all of those things happened. And I thank you so much for joining me for this podcast special. This has been an absolute delight.
It's been my total pleasure. I'm proud to be your 200th, and I hope I'll be your 400th.
Well, you know, we've got Some of All Fears to do next, and I think you've said that you'll come back and do that, and hopefully we can tempt you to the UK at some point, and then we can do it all again.
Love to.
Phil Alden Robinson, thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Simon.
And that brings to the end my conversation with Phil Alden Robinson and my conversation about Field of Dreams, which I think you can probably tell from that is a film that's very, very special to me. Ordinarily, at the end of an episode, I give you all the places where you can get in touch with me and find out more about film stories. This time, I just want to do something different. And again, just going to the whole personal self-indulgence of this episode, I just actually want to say thank you to you all. When I first started Film Stories back in the summer of 2018, and I think some people know this story, I was not in a good place at all, that my job that I loved was coming to an end, not in a way that I wanted to, that I'd gone through the loss of my mum, which was all fairly sudden. And I just sat down one evening with a microphone and started talking just to try and get back some headspace. What I never expected was the response that I got. And I will forever be grateful for that, that at the point where I most needed people to have my back, they had my back. For the support that you've shown me over the 200 episodes, be this your first, even if you've been there right from the start, whatever, I can't thank you enough. You've made an old nerd very, very happy. And as I come to the end of episode 200 with an awful lot of more planned, I'd just like, really, before I start getting completely choked up, to say thank you. I'll be back with your regular episode of Film Stories soon. Most important thing, as always, is you all take care, you all look after yourselves. Thanks for everything, everyone. Bye bye.
Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.